Welcome to episode 84 of Bite-Sized Blessings. In this episode, I get to interview Dr. Andrew Lustig, who, among many other careers in his life, is currently working with an organization that he founded and of which he's the president, Global Outreach Doctors. On their website, it says, with its first mission in Nepal for the massive 7.8 earthquake on April 25, 2015, Global Outreach Doctors sent an initial team of 9 medical and search and rescue staff with 3 canines within only 64 hours of the disaster, and they've been doing good works like that ever since. While Global Outreach Doctors is heavily involved right now with the humanitarian crisis that's happening in Ukraine, they've also done good works in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Iraq, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Nepal, among many other places. They are a team of dedicated volunteer medical professionals, including doctors, nurses, paramedics, naturopaths, homeopaths, acupuncturists, and psychologists. Again, from the website, the Global Outreach Doctors staff and partners collectively have worked in almost every corner of the globe. And so while doing research for this episode, I discovered that Dr. Lustig was once the CEO of a media company in New York, which begs the question, how does one go from CEO of a media company to doing great humanitarian works in the world? And I just knew that his journey and his story was going to be one of the miracles I heard when I talked to him. I just love the story of people's journeys. They're always so surprising. Where you think you're supposed to end up sometimes is not where you end up, but somehow you end up in exactly the right place. And when you listen to this episode, I think you'll see that Dr. Lustig is exactly where he's supposed to be. So now, without further ado, episode 84 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
On two occasions, I was in the back of an ambulance and I was alone because other team members were outside of the ambulance doing something else. And the patient I was caring for died. And in both occasions, the monitor went flatline. They had a do not resuscitate, or there was another reason why they would not be receive CPR. And within just a few seconds, I witnessed sort of this shape move from their head up into the air above them. The way I describe myself first and foremost is really as a father. I have 2 beautiful children, and I think that is the most important thing that I've ever done in my life, to put 2 human beings on the planet that will contribute in their own way. Of course, then as we get into discussions, you know, I will mention my former life as a corporate CEO of a media company and my current life as the CEO of a global medical relief charity. But, you know, as a human being, it's important for me to demonstrate that I think the highest value is my children and what they produce in the world. You know, when I was young, Kirsten, we were in a family unit that went to synagogue occasionally on important holidays, but we didn't really practice religious beliefs. It was pretty much in my 20s that I developed my own belief about a higher power. And I think that came from just feeling very fortunate and having some very close calls and brushes with death and injury and my children, that I would look up at the sky and just thank the higher power for protecting me. Power and spirit is really channeled through what human beings do and say and act every day. And I don't necessarily believe that there is some force telling us what to do. It's more of us receiving and using the higher power we have. I can tell you that when I was a corporate CEO, there was so much in my brain, and a fair amount of it was toxic because it was basically kill or get killed, that I didn't have the power and the abilities that I have now. And I only recognized that after walking away from the corporate world. And it was really only 6 months to a year that I would think of a person that I maybe had never spoken to in, you know, 5 years, and they would call me, or I would call somebody that was not expecting my call, that I haven't spoken to, that it wasn't planned. And they would say, I can't believe you've just called me. I am just thinking about you, or I have my mouse cursor on your name. This is so uncanny. And I almost use that today because it happens so regularly, Kirsten, as a shortcut. You know, I'm going to think of John and I expect that he will probably call me, and he does, or vice versa. There was one, at one point I was driving through a small town on the East Coast and I was thinking of somebody, and they walked right in front of my car at a stop sign, and there was not a chance that they lived there or anything else. And I didn't know they were in the town or whatever. So I do believe that we receive from a higher power, and that if we sort of clear our mind and our heart, we can use these tools, you know, very, very effectively, and to benefit each other and in kindness and in tuition and so on. I studied film and television in college, and my first job in New York was watching parking lots for Woody Allen overnight so that nobody parked in there, so that when the crew showed up, they could set up their trucks and so on. And then I was a production assistant for various commercial firms, some very famous commercial directors, who at that time would get on their bullhorn and be up in a crane and scream for 14 hours at the crew down below. After that, I worked a number of other production for film and television. I then joined an organization in the teleproduction industry, which is post-production and shooting stages. I worked my way up the ladder. My family was the owner of this facility. I worked every single job in that, from shipping, when I used to bring audio tapes, reel-to-reel audio tapes, to radio stations to play commercials and travel on the subway all over New York, to eventually editing commercials for TV and radio, and then working in sales, working in public relations, eventually into an executive role, eventually buying out all of the partners and taking over the company and becoming the CEO.
That's quite a journey. But you were saying earlier that it was toxic. I can't imagine the amount of stress you must have had in that position.
You know, my early corporate life, when I think back about it, Kirsten, it stuns me that I survived it. I've always put one foot in front of the other. My whole life has been about problem solving. You know, my problem solving now is very different than it was in corporate life. My problem solving now, living on a horse ranch, is medicating a horse and taking care of injuries because they always get themselves in trouble, and figuring out the flooding that's happening on my property, on my acreage, because we have a storm, and dealing with broken fences and broken tractors and so on. And of course, problem solving with our team in Ukraine, running global outreach doctors and deploying people to the front line, has a myriad of complications, most of which start at 3 a.m. because they are 9 hours ahead of me and it's already noon there. And there are problems that need some of my support. Back in the corporate life, the issues were, you know, very important clients that had tremendous spending that we needed to cater to, every whim that they had, to unfortunately, very litigious. The media world was very litigious. I believe still is very litigious, though I've been out of it for 20 years. So I was very often, Kirsten, in courtrooms. And I was either on one side of the table or another side of the table, either in contract, employee, real estate law. There were companies that went bankrupt that owed us money. So, you know, it certainly, you know, there was a fair amount of high level stress, in addition to the cost, the high level cost of equipment that we had to keep purchasing to keep up with the demands of our clients' needs. And the equipment became less and less expensive, which then the priority was, well, if the client might buy it themselves because now it's accessible. It used to be that I ran a facility with dozens of editing rooms and each room cost $1 million. But years later, some of those editing rooms could be bought by a client and they could work in their living room with a couple of Macs and you know, maybe $100,000 or $200,000. That created this cycle of constantly looking for the best advantage we can offer the clients. There was just sort of a 6-month period of me saying to myself, what am I going to do in the world to make it a better place? What I'm doing now as a corporate executive is ensuring myself a lot of financial gains and a lot of other people financial gains and making television and making records. We had a record company, we had graphics and so on. And I don't really think it was socially redeemable product that created good in the world. It certainly provided entertainment. However, later in my life, I was thinking, how can I actually improve lives? And entertainment did not seem to be enough to me. You know, one day I walked out of my building and I called my CFO up and I said, I'm done. I'm not coming back into that building. We're going to have to scale this thing down. We're going to sell. We're going to do whatever, because I want to do something more meaningful with my life. I want to create a benefit for more people in that had less than me. And that, Kirsten, is when I decided that one way to do that was to become an EMT and work emergency medical technician and work on an ambulance. And so I trained to do that. And I began working on ambulances where occasionally you would save a life, but most often you would improve a life. Because unlike, you know, what you see on TV, sometimes you get a bee sting. And sometimes you get somebody that broke a leg. And on occasion, you get somebody that needs to be saved. And without your help, they're going to die. And I've had people die in my arms. And I've also had people that were mildly sick. Over that period of time, I also became a naturopathic doctor. What I wanted to do was provide a variety of medical care, both in the traditional medical world of allopathic, but also as a naturopathic doctor using healing modalities that have advantages over the emergency medicine world that I was in. It also allowed me to spend more time and monitor the change in the patient, because as an EMT, you might have the patient for 20 minutes in the ambulance. And unless they were a frequent flyer, which is basically a patient that keeps needing an ambulance, you really don't have follow through. What happened to the patient? Did they get better? You know, you drop them at the hospital. At one point, I worked in an ambulance and then my shift at the hospital started. So I quickly changed out of my emergency medical technician's clothing and I put on my hospital scrubs and started working in the hospital. And sometimes the same patient I brought there, I showed up and they said, wait a second, you're the guy that dropped me off here. And I said, yeah, my shift is on. Now I'm going to take care of you in the hospital. As I became a naturopathic doctor and when I received my degree, I started to work in Africa and in the Amazon jungle and lots of places with other NGOs, with other non-government organization charities, and watched how they as a organization provided medical care to communities in need. Eventually, after working for many NGOs, I started Global Outreach Doctors, which is now working around the world in war zones, earthquakes, typhoons, in high need, low resource areas like Ethiopia on a mountaintop with no electricity, assisting delivering babies that whose mothers arrive on donkeys because there's no cow, there's no cars up there at 10,000 feet and there's no electricity. Or in war zones for the Battle of Mosul in Iraq, or currently in Ukraine on the front lines, or on the border of Syria, handling enormous amounts of refugees with the United Nations Commissioner of High Refugee, or even with the U.S. Navy helping with the Venezuela refugee crisis, working on their U.S. hospital comfort ship, which is basically an aircraft carrier with, you know, mobile surgical rooms and clinics and so on. We've worked 38 missions in 7 years, some of them repeat missions. And I would say the culmination of our skill set and ability and the size and scope of what we're involved in would be currently, the largest would be the Ukraine war, where our teams are on the front lines, where we have 11 ambulances in the country, where we have provided $300,000 of financial support to hospitals around the country of Ukraine, and where we're about to supply another $200,000 of delivery of medical equipment. You know, as an EMT for many years, I'm still licensed. I don't practice anymore. I don't practice naturopathic medicine either. I run my charity, Global Outreach Doctors, full time. I have enough medical knowledge to know who to deploy into what areas and what skill sets they'll bring to bear. As an EMT, and like many paramedics that have worked any kind of acute, chronic ambulance work, you know, you will most likely experience a death, several. There was a period of time when I was working on the ambulance very regularly, and there seemed to be a string of people that, for whatever reason, were acutely sick and died. On two occasions, I was in the back of an ambulance, and I was alone because other team members were outside of the ambulance doing something else. And the patient I was caring for died. And in both occasions, the monitor went flatline. They had a do not resuscitate, or there was another reason why they would not be receive CPR. And within just a few seconds, I witnessed sort of this shape move from their head up into the air above them. In one case, the woman expired, and I saw some type of shape, some type of image come from her head and move into the space above her head. And, you know, I thought of, at the moment, the weight of a dime, which people know is the weight of a dime is what a deceased person weighs less than when they were alive. And in another occasion, somebody also died. And I was, as I said, alone in the ambulance. And I think I'm clarifying that I was alone in the ambulance because I think that's when sort of it's just you and them, you know, and there isn't a lot of distraction and your eyes are looking at each other and there aren't a lot of other eyes looking and there's not a lot of other commotion. And so that sort of unique bond between you and your patient at the time that they die could produce what I witnessed, which was this image lifting from their body.
I'm intrigued. Did you step back, you know, in your mind and think, wait, what's going on here?
I think I was stunned because the first time it happened to me, of course, I didn't have a history. The second time it's like, oh, I've seen this before. This is familiar. The first time I just was frozen for a few seconds, saying to myself, what did I just witness? I know I saw this. I'm pretty practical. You know, I'm pretty much not somebody that believes in a lot of foo-foo, woo-woo stuff. This caught me off guard. And when it happened the second time, it's like, okay, this is what happens. Yes, you know, I get it. You know, when I was a young father and my son was, I think, about 6 or 7, we were on our farm in Connecticut at the time when I lived there. And my son and I were picking apples. And I was driving a large 7,000-pound tractor. And I would give my son a ride in the front bucket of this tractor. And so he would sit in the tractor, and then I would park the tractor, put the brake on, lower the bucket. He would jump out and we would start picking apples. So we were doing that exact thing. And I lowered the bucket and he stepped out and I put the parking brake on and I walked out off the tractor to meet him. And the tractor brake released and rolled over my son. And the tractor's back tire came to rest on my son's 6-year-old son's head. It had rained extensively the day before, and the ground was soft. I got back on the tractor and backed this 7,000-pound vehicle off of my son's head. At the time, I did not have medical knowledge, and I picked him up and saw the tread mark on the side of his head. But what I noticed was that his head had pushed into the mud because the ground was soft and the tractor had rested on him between two large treads. So there was somewhat of a space. And I rushed him to the emergency room and I explained to them that a 7,000-pound tractor landed on top of my son's head. And they said, "Oh, do you mean your lawnmower?" No, I said, "No, I mean an almost commercial 7,000-pound tractor." So they grabbed him from me and rushed him into do scans of his brain. And miraculously, he had no injuries. You know, it is quite miraculous because everything had to line up there. It had to have rained. The ground had to be soft. The space between two massive treads on very, very large 5-foot tires had to rest between my son's head. Something special about my son, because that is not the only incident that happened when he was young. My son had another incident which happened only a few years later. My family and I were sitting in a cafe with a large glass front, and the cars would come and park in front of that glass front, and you'd go through the front door and sit down. We were all sitting having something to eat, and a car came barreling through the parking area and went right through the glass front. And at the time, we were not sitting close to where that car came into the store, but I had sent my son to go take something to the recycle bin, which was directly in front of where that vehicle came through. The car crashed through, the ceiling came down, glass everywhere, and stopped 6 inches from my son, and who was standing there stunned. And of course, I rushed over, and he was basically sitting under the car, the front bumper of the car, but had not been struck. He just fell back. And I grabbed him and inspected him. He had a few scratches from the shattered glass, but he was fine. Another amazing miracle, the timing of which I mean, what if he had made it to exactly the location he was getting rid of the recycle? And because that was crushed. What if he was not sent to go recycle and he was still sitting with us? What if that car moved just a few feet more? So, a stunning example of just, and that is also when I kind of look up and realize how fortunate I was in that incident, but I also have a very fortunate life. I don't live the expansive, expensive life of the East Coast anymore. I live in a rural community in New Mexico, and I don't have a high pressure job, and I don't make the kind of money I used to make. And so I'm in incidents like what happened with my son, I just stop and look up. Because there is some guiding force that protected that young boy. And there is some guiding force that's protected me to be able to give back to thousands and thousands of people that we have saved their lives or improved their lives. I don't think there are many accidents. I think there are synchronicities. And I think my leaving corporate America to be able to provide kindness and support to those in need is very fulfilling for me.
Thank you so much for listening to episode 84 of Bite-Sized Blessings, where I had the distinct pleasure to interview the kind and fearless Dr. Andrew Lustig. To read more about the group Global Outreach Doctors, go to globaloutreachdoctors.org. There, you can find out more about the many missions they've embarked on in the world, but you can also donate to this very worthwhile cause. I need to thank the creators of the music used for this episode as well, Alexander Nakarada, Raphael Crux, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please go to the Bite Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to other artists, books, music, and especially under Dr. Lustig's episode, a link to globaloutreachdoctors.org. I hope each and every one of these lightens and brightens your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Andrew. Be fearless. Be inquisitive. Be open to the mystery. And have trust and follow that mystery no matter where it takes you.